Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, April 25th, 2009. My name is Marcia Mary Baker, and our topic for today is LaRouche's Influence Spreads, the case of Ukraine and Russia. We are speaking in particular today with two guests in our studio who were in Ukraine over a week period, including a conference April 9th and 10th in Kiev. And these are Rachel Douglas, who is known to many of you over the years and decades. She's our EIR Russia and Eastern European editor. She's a longtime associate of Mr. LaRouche and representative of his and of the Schiller Institute, as well as the Executive Intelligence Review. In Russia, in Ukraine, and throughout actually Eastern Europe, the former states of the Soviet Union, and she has she's very active in that way. And also, who we welcome, Summer Shields, who's
Sky.
Sky Shields. Let me say right now, thank you for laughing, Sky. Summer Shields will be on this show May 2nd.
Yes, okay.
He was in Africa over the same period in Sudan. Welcome, Sky.
Thank you.
Who is a very close associate and activist with Mr. LaRouche, a leader of the basement team, you might call it, that's literally in the basement, but leading the charge for a renaissance of thinking for and World Youth Movement for Strategic Intervention in the world situation today. And they will describe what they were doing over this period in Ukraine, but they were attending a conference in Kiev at the National Economic University there. I want to, just before turning it over to open this with Rachel, to identify for everyone that Mr. LaRouche, 3 days from now, on April 28th, is holding an international webcast. It will be beamed from Washington, D.C., live, interactive, held by the LaRouche Political Action Committee. You can find that at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, Tuesday, April 28th, on www.larouchepac.com, LaRouchePac.com. So, Rachel, what took you there?
Well, the conference we attended, Marcia, was called Physical Economy, Research Methodology and the Global Mission of Ukraine. This conference was held jointly by the Kiev National Economic University, which is the second largest institution of higher learning in the capital of Ukraine and the one that trains people in economics. And it was co-sponsored by the Sergei Podolinsky Scientific Society, which has existed since the mid-1990s and which came into existence as a result of initiatives and efforts taken by the Schiller Institute and also people in Ukraine, including the former head of the Schiller Institute in Moscow, the late Professor Taras Muranivsky. We'll get to the content of that main conference that we attended because, appropriately enough, in the midst of the current systemic breakdown of the global economy, the issues on the table were issues of profound ones of science, scientific method, scientific approaches to the economic area, physical economy, which has become really a subject in its own right in these Ukrainian institutions. And Sky will go through some of the scientific content of the discussion, both what we brought there with his presentation and Mr. LaRouche's presentation, and also some of the speeches given by Ukrainian economists themselves. But I wanted just to say, first of all, that the impact of LaRouche representatives being in Ukraine for 8 days, really for the first time in some years, was extraordinary. And that our activities outside of the main conference have been generating a rash of press coverage and internet coverage in particular, which is ongoing right up through yesterday. I can give you two examples. One is that during the conference, Mr. LaRouche's intervention and presentation, which included an excerpt with Russian language voiceover, which we presented of Lyndon LaRouche's March 21st webcast. We can get to what the content of that was. Coverage on a website of a significant political party in Ukraine, the PSPU of Natalia Vitrenko, was headlined, "The Economists Who Got the World Into This Mess Should Shut Up," which was a direct quotation from the LaRouche passage that we showed. And that has now been followed by the publication yesterday of a full transcript of a seminar that Skye and I presented on the 13th of April. Now, note the timeline, because Lyndon LaRouche has been increasing the frequency of his webcast dialogue with the people of the United States and the world, given the utter inadequacy and worse of policy from our own government and international governments, especially after the early April G20 meeting. So the main conference we addressed was April 9th. On Saturday, April 11th, Lyndon LaRouche gave his webcast titled "The Narcissus Syndrome of President Obama," in which he laid out the bitter, mortal fight between the behavioral economist school of free market criminals on the one side and our tendency, LaRouche, Franklin Roosevelt, the American system, the principle, the constitutional principle of the general welfare on the other. So while we were not able to hear that webcast on the 11th live, we read it. We were able to receive staff bulletins from headquarters, from LaRouche PAC. So we read that, and on Monday the 13th, we presented it in a verbal summary of that American fight to an audience of economists and political analysts in Kiev. They've gone and published the entire transcript under the headline, "The Bankruptcy of the World Financial System." So now a large readership body, both in Ukraine and in Russia, has access in the Russian language to that up to the minute at that time, a reading from LaRouche on what the stakes are, that if policy is not changed, the population of this planet will drop from 6.5 billion to 2.5 billion. I know Marcia's been focusing on swine flu today, but we'll talk about that another time, I think. And that fundamental issue of survival of the human species on this planet, in the biosphere, in the cosmos, as Vladimir Vernadsky would say, that the stakes are very high. Skye, as we were leaving Ukraine, remarked as we were discussing follow-up and people we had met with, that all of the intellectual discussions we had during this trip were extremely rich. They were also, as he put it, high stakes.
People recognize that there was, that, to put it in context, in general, the response to LaRouche has described the response to his webcast statements on Obama in the last webcast as having been generally a fear response in certain circles in the United States. But he said among honest circles, people who are seriously interested in maintaining the survival of the human species in the near term, they took it with a sigh of relief, and they're rather happy that he said it and they didn't have to. And I think that was in general the response that we got throughout Ukraine. Because people could see, there may be certain delusions that people have inside the United States, but in general, I think amongst the people we were talking with, they could see that what was coming out, that if not that human civilization won't survive what's coming out of this administration. They recognize that at least their country, people close to them, that the crisis will worsen with the current behavior of the Obama administration. And we were able to provide for them LaRouche's assessment and make it clear who's the source of this, what flaws on Obama's part, on President Obama's part, are making him susceptible to this, and what the fight is coming from us inside the United States to turn it around. And I think in general, my impression was that people were relieved to hear that.
I think so. And it's of course challenging for us to discuss the sine qua non, that without which a solution won't be found, in a country like Ukraine. Because what is that critical element? As LaRouche has said in every presentation for the last 2 years, there must be an initiative by the great powers, the countries which have the power and ability, the strength to stand up to the British Empire, that global financial slime mold with its center in London. And those powers are the United States, Russia, China, and India. Now, where's Ukraine? Ukraine, for those who haven't looked at the map lately, is not just an extension of Russia somehow. It's an independent sovereign country since the breakup of the Soviet Union in 1991. It has 46 million people. It used to have 50 million people, as a matter of fact. So these issues of population collapse, mass deaths, are not abstract for many with whom we were meeting. Both because of the last 100 years' history. Ukraine experienced a horrific famine in 1932-33, which it used to be taboo to talk about, but now it's the subject of monuments throughout the country. Sometimes it's politicized by people who'd like to use that history to drive a wedge between Russia and Ukraine, but also because of the last 20 years with a dropping standard of living, millions of Gastarbeiter, guest workers. These are labor migrants, young Ukrainians, working age Ukrainians, Ukrainian girls lured into sex operations, becoming commercial sex workers when they didn't intend to, in the Middle East or in Europe. Men going to Russia as guest worker construction workers. This has been the experience of Ukraine over the last almost now 2 decades. And of course, at the top level, people, I think, who follow the EIR and the LaRouche show know that Ukraine has been a giant laboratory for a manipulated, synthetic, so-called democratic revolution, which was not democratic at all, but was one of these synthetic, image-centered social engineering projects that we otherwise see in rock music and the whole video culture. That was the Orange Revolution in 2004. Now, that's when the guy who had won the elections was then accused of vote fraud. His victory was canceled, and NGOs heavily financed by so-called Project Democracy, by George Soros's Open Society Institute and related groups, engineered a coup, a counter thrust, and brought alleged democratic groupings to power. This was simply another power play. And since then, there have been 3 parliamentary elections and 4 governments in 3.5 years. So that many people are very cynical about politics, and the idea that LaRouche says everything depends on something good being done by the United States or by Russia is initially viewed with some skepticism, especially also in view of the fights over natural gas pricing between Russia and Ukraine. But that's not the end of the story. And I think if we look at what the leading circles who organized and attended and took part in the conference where we spoke, and what their response was, you can see that there's something much more substantial going on in the thinking of people in this large European country under these crisis conditions. Why don't, Skye, if you could give a rundown on what happened at the conference and who spoke and so on, that might be helpful for our listeners.
I can give a picture. Rachel discussed the theme, which was I think for people who are used to members of our political movement, who are used to organizing amongst the U.S. population and then our readership and listenership to this program, would be interested to realize that there was a large university. It's interesting for a large university anywhere to be hosting a conference whose theme is physical economy. I can discuss. There's sort of a, you know, there's a wide range of interpretations that fell under that that came from the different presenters. What was unified among them was the recognition that the types of just radical monetarism and speculation that we've seen over the last decades needs to be done away with and replaced with something that has that is more closely and intimately connected to the physical development of human society. And this was the theme of a number of the presentations, which included, you know, to my excitement and surprise, a number of presentations on LaRouche directly by a number of these different intellectuals, professors in a couple of cases, heads of other institutes, that there's a recognition that this idea, the main living representative of this idea is Lyndon LaRouche. Into that, LaRouche made the point, made a very, I think, pertinent intervention with a paper he delivered to the conference, which was titled The Principle of Mind.
Can I just throw in here that people listening to this or on the website, it's April 3rd, 2009 EIR.
Okay.
April 3rd, 2009 on LaRouchePub.com as well as on LaRouchePack.com.
Which is an excellent, and people should take a look, and you can see, you can imagine for yourself while reading this paper, this Principle of Mind paper, that this is the environment, that you've got this collection of intellectuals from Ukraine, Russia, us as representatives there from the United States and elsewhere. There are people from Nigeria.
Belarus, China,
yes.
Nigeria.
It was a very broad, and all of them there to discuss what are, in essence, Lynn's ideas, LaRouche's ideas. Only a number of them but a large number of them were familiar with LaRouche by name and had been following the EIR publications, other economic publications by Mr. LaRouche himself. So into that, this is the environment he's intervening into. And into that, he presents his paper where the core idea is that physical economics is at heart not the core element of physical economics is not the what you might call the physics of the process. It's not, you're not deriving, the wealth is not neither derived from the land nor from labor per se, but it's derived specifically from the creative capability, the creative activity, you might say the creative labors of the individual human mind, the works which are best expressed in the areas of physical science and classical artistic composition. And so we intervened with that as sort of the theme to broaden the discussion to say, well, if you're discussing physical economic development, the physical economic development of the human species, you're discussing the development of this creative capacity in your population as a whole. And then from that, that's the source of wealth. From that, you begin to see the applications in physical economy. You see the applications in the development but the improvement, the constant improvement of your productive capabilities, the constant improvement of social conditions, that it comes from having that be this principle of mind be the focus of your economic policy making and general economic strategic outlook.
And going back on the history of this, I mean, that's been addressed by LaRouche himself, but this part of the world, the geochemistry, soil science that's given the nomenclature to all soils in the world.
The towering figure for the principle and the approach that Sky was just summarizing is Vladimir Vernadsky. And I think LaRouche is, among living writers, the person who's published the largest number of essays.
Certainly the most insightful.
And as well as those with the richest content, reviving the work of Vernadsky, giving Vernadsky's work, which, yes, began with soil science, and we had a chance to see what that looked like in the area where in the 1890s Vladimir Vernadsky conducted his first soil research, but developed quickly in the subsequent decades into the concept of the biosphere, that is the envelope of the earth in which life is present, and what he called the noosphere, the sphere of creative reason. Now, I should say that the lifespan of Vladimir Vernadsky is 1863 to 1945, which is, it's extremely productive in terms of current history, recent history, to reflect on that period of time. You see, you notice that the year of his death is the same as the year, the end of World War II and the death of Roosevelt. And in fact, in presenting Lyndon's paper, obviously a 12,000 word article was not possible to read aloud in the allotted half hour, so we showed part of a webcast and read Mr. LaRouche's greeting to the conference. But I also was able to take out a few passages of The Principle of Mind to present in the Russian language. It has been translated. And I took a passage from the middle where LaRouche refers to the coherence of Vernadsky's scientific outlook with the economic policy and political outlook of Roosevelt at the end of World War II. That is, Vernadsky thinking in terms of the increasingly conscious transformation of the planet, and as he saw it subsequently, the solar system and the cosmos, by humans, by the species that can think. The coherence of that with Roosevelt's commitment to get rid of colonialism and allow every nation to develop new geniuses. So the figure, Vernadsky lived in that time period, and as one of the scientists who addressed the conference said, is still alive. His personality is very much with us in these forms of study. And so we focused on Vernadsky, Sky did in his presentation, Lyndon did in his paper, and we did in our visit in a very exciting way. Our hosts asked us whom we would like to meet. And since with a part of the basement team, we've had and myself, as knowing the Russian language, we've had a seminar in the last 2 years involved in translating some of the late works of Vernadsky about time and space and life processes. We asked our hosts if it were possible to meet any experts in this field. And the response was a trip to a different town, a city called Kremenchuk, which is not even a regional capital. It's the second biggest city in the Ukrainian region called Poltava. It's the historic heart of Ukraine, further downstream to the south, downstream on the Dnieper River, to the southeast from Kiev towards the Black Sea. This is the area where Peter the Great, in the beginning of the 18th century, defeated the last hetman, chief of Ukraine, named Mazepa. And it's also in the heart of the Black Earth Belt. Just to say what that is, this is the type of soil known as Chernozem, which means literally black earth. And 40% of the planet's black earth, which is the richest soil on the planet Earth, is in Ukraine. A good deal of another portion is in Iowa,
yeah.
As we know. And this is both the area of the furthest southward reach of the last glaciation, but also, I think in both cases, certainly
yes.
In Ukraine, it's the former bed of an inland sea.
Right.
So mm-hmm. You have that organic component as well. So our host on this visit was the scientific advisor to the Kremenchuk Regional Museum. I should also say that this is a town which was right in the pathway of the Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union during World War II. At the end of that war, only 3% of the buildings were standing in the town. Actually, one of them is the former Victoria Hotel, unfortunately named for the drug addict, not amused queen of the British Empire in the 19th century herself. But that hotel happens to be where Vladimir Vernadsky and his teacher, the soil scientist Dokuchaev, stayed when they came to Poltava in 1890 to do research on this soil. And by the way, this whole soil science or investigation of soil as a body or an entity, this had developed very quickly, including through the collaboration of a Russian scientist, Mendeleev, Dmitry Mendeleev, who you know from the periodic table of the elements, with the Americans. Mm-hmm. When Mendeleev came to Philadelphia to attend our centennial exhibition in what's now Fairmount Park in Philadelphia, which was organized by the Henry Carey circles, the heirs of Lincoln, his agenda, Mendeleev's agenda for discussions with the Americans included soil science and oil, because the center of the American oil industry at that point was in Pennsylvania, not in Texas.
It's significant. I know one, I don't know how much of the people realize, like the soil, it's a funny because it's got all the incredible practical, it's the human, in order to survive, to be able to have efficient agricultural development and have that play the role it plays in economic development, you obviously have to have a developed understanding of soils. But also, this forms the basis for all of Vernadsky's later work. His development of Einstein's work on relativity starts from what he and Dokuchaev recognize about soil, which is that it's a distinct state of matter. You know, you could ask the question, well, what's non-living, what's living? But then with soil, they realize they're looking at something that you couldn't really say was either. That if you were to properly classify it, it's what Vernadsky later calls bio-inert. That it's something that exists, it's an example of the abiotic being organized by the biosphere. And so this is excitement. Looking at this, you realize this is where Vernadsky begins to develop his ideas of the living as a completely distinct state mm-hmm. of matter.
Now, Vernadsky, I should say, was Ukrainian, but he had gone to university in St. Petersburg and was back and forth to Russia. So he's equally a Russian scientist. And in my mind, it always strikes me that with Vernadsky's work, his collaboration with Dokuchaev, the role of the heritage of Mendeleev, who's Russian, in the work of the Ukrainian Vernadsky, there you have the solution for Russian-Ukrainian relations. There you have the domain in which they can and must proceed harmoniously. And I know that our Moscow Schiller Institute leader, Taras Muranivsky, who was born in Ukraine and lived in Moscow for 40 years, thought that way as well. So the the museum in Kremenchuk, the regional museum, was organized clearly on the same principle or with the same approach as Lyndon LaRouche has often commented on as so striking in Moscow at the Vernadsky State Geological Museum of the Russian Academy of Sciences, which in 2001, Mr. and Mrs. LaRouche had a full tour of by its director. And like the museum in Moscow, the one in Kremenchuk goes from the soil, which is mm-hmm. laid out in the basement. They have a basement too, with displays on how it came into being and how there's iron ore there and the role of the different types of granite. And then
do they do the biotic with the worms and the microbes?
Well, I don't think they necessarily had worms and microbes in this particular museum, but they definitely had some very nice-looking stuffed woodpeckers and
and
falcons.
Freeze-dried fish.
Yes, yeah. Freeze-dried fish. Yes, they had because when we got up to the second floor, there was the flora and fauna of the region, and then you began to have the human element with various artifacts, which Vernadsky also collected, by the way, during the period that they were studying the soil. In some of the digging, they would come upon artifacts of earlier stages of the hunting culture and so on. in this region. So all these human elements are there and were discussed in very interesting terms by our host. And then after a just heart-wrenching room devoted to the destruction during World War II and the resistance. And this, by the way, the museum was, the polemic in the World War II room had to do with the multi-ethnic nature of the resistance, mm-hmm. that here was a guy who led the partisan fight in the area surrounding Kremenchuk, and he was Armenian, and here's a guy who was Russian, and somebody else was Jewish, and this was brought out in that room. But the top floor was on space exploration. And here we had some things brought to our attention which had only been there vaguely in my mind, which are tremendously exciting. The scientific director of the museum, Mr. Ignatienko, is also the author of a book on a fellow named Kondratyuk, who's known as the Ukrainian Tsiolkovsky. Well, Tsiolkovsky was the Russian visionary pioneer of conceptualizer of spaceflight. Kondratyuk wrote in 1929 a pamphlet called on Future Interplanetary Travel. And it so happened that in the 1960s, when NASA was hosting debates about how we were going to go to the moon, the famous NASA scientist Hubelt went to the Library of Congress and was casing the joint, looking for everything ever written on different concepts of interplanetary trajectories and travel. And instead of doing what was being argued by some, which was the straight shot, use as little fuel as possible idea, we adopted the Ukrainian trajectory, which involved using the gravitational field of the Earth and then later of the Moon for what's called an assist or a boost to an orbiting spacecraft. And the briefing we got on this from this museum head was one of pride and also a very devoted future orientation, where it was clear that this gentleman was committed that these ideas and this kind of generation of this kind of breakthrough was not just something in a museum, but that it should be happening again.
And that you saw really manifested this idea of physical economy. LaRouche's broader idea of physical economy, that it's the development of human creativity and then the overall development of the human species. It's not managing flows of resources. It's not certainly not managing monetary flows. But it really is directing, it's taking a look at the human species as a geological force and as an interplanetary force, and then developing it from that point of view, which is completely different than the people who are, it's certainly different than the lunatics who you've got who created the current crisis, the lunatic monetarists who created the crisis we're currently in now. It's on a completely other planet from the freaks you've got controlling the Obama administration, these behaviorists who think that economics is sort of controlling every animal passion of every individual human being on the planet and directing it towards financial profit. This is something that's organized on the basis of what does humanity do as a species and what's our role in the solar system and the universe more broadly. And from that point of view, you're looking at questions of resource allocation, etc. But you saw this manifest in the museum, and you saw why Vernadsky's ideas were so crucial to this sort of progress, are so crucial to addressing the current crisis we're in today.
And let me ask either one of you, the gentleman Podolinsky, who after whom the society is named, connected to the Schiller Institute, this is part of the same stream of thought historically.
Podolinsky was half a generation older than Vernadsky. So he was born in 1850,
okay.
I believe. He only lived to 1891. And it's hard to give a comprehensive evaluation of Podolinsky because almost none of him has been translated, mm-hmm. Even into Russian. Actually, the late Pobisk Kuznetsov, who's a Moscow scientist who also became a friend of LaRouche and debated these questions of the source of wealth intensely with LaRouche, had revived Podolinsky and brought about the publication of a short pamphlet of his called Human Labor and Its Relationship to the Distribution of Energy, which Podolinsky had written in 1880. And from our review of Pobis Kuznetsov's summary of the matter and Taras Muranivsky's summary of the matter, it seemed to us that that was the most advanced, that pamphlet contained perhaps the most advanced concept that Podolinsky had, in that he talked about human activity transforming the quality of energy. Professor Muranivsky at the time drew a parallel between that and the way in which LaRouche looks at the Leibnizian concept of energy flux density in physical economic processes. However, there's a danger, which...
Well, I could say, yeah, that you see in there, what you see in there, and I think you just get more and express in a more accentuated way with LaRouche's works, is that it's actually not, I mean, they're correct, certain correct observations that even from just a pure energy accounting standpoint, you can't make the argument that all of this is coming from simply from the earth and the raw materials, because from an energy standpoint, the solar system and then the universe more broadly is an open system. It really is that transformations in the earth are governed by what's taking place in the Crab Nebula. And Podolinsky apparently stressed that a number of these phenomena are governed by what's taking, are in an open interaction with what's taking place on the sun. That's certainly the case. What LaRouche has stressed repeatedly with his idea of energy flux density, however, is that it is not the, in no case is the quantity of energy essentially significant when discussing economic processes or even biological processes. But what's important is the geometric qualitative nature of that energy, the organization of it. Energy viewed as not as a scalar magnitude or simply a vector magnitude, but as a geometric quantity that has an internal quality that affects how that energy is used. I mean, the simple pedagogy we've often used is how much coal would it take to fire a rocket to the moon? You know, how much that it's not that you could, in terms of just in calculating, you could calculate a certain quantity of coal whose heat production would be equivalent to, say, a certain amount of uranium ore. But now, could you use that to power a shuttle?
Right.
Could you use that to power any aspect of modern technology? You can picture people, you know, plugging their their laptops into some coal furnace in their basement, trying to power it. That is not the quantity of energy. It really is a question of the organization. But then, if you look at more developed questions, we've been making the polemic recently against the real lunatic idea of trying to power something with solar power. You take a look at how solar power is used in a solar cell versus how it's more properly used by a plant in transforming that radiant energy, transforming fairly dispersed radiant energy into very complicated structures, carbohydrates, really the building block of all living material. You start to realize that it's not the quantity of energy, but it really is the organization of that energy that gives you its actual value, because a living organism, there's no number of power cells, of solar cells, you could put together to produce a living organism.
Yeah, you began the show by pointing out the important timing of your dialogue in Ukraine with people from China, from Russia, from Belarus, from everywhere, and what's going on in Washington, where we see this, where it's critical what direction Washington is going to take, and we're intervening to change it. But these crazies, criminal crazies that are around Obama and the administration yesterday, it's funny you should mention everything about energy. It's not just quantification. Mm-hmm. Literally, you had Al Gore, Newt Gingrich, Ed Markey from Massachusetts, almost discussing energy in terms of how much carbon dioxide you can put on the head of a pin. I mean, beyond the Mad Hatter's Tea Party.
It is absolutely, and the thing is, it's incompetent. It's scientifically incompetent. Even outside of economics, and this is clear, again, in biology, all of Vernadsky's work refutes the simplistic types of energy accounting methods you get from all the environmentalists right now. The real simplistic view of what human creativity is, the real simplistic view of things like pollutants that you get from them. And it's significant to use Vernadsky in the refutation of these guys, because Vernadsky is the one Vernadsky is the person who creates the idea in any kind of substantial form of the biosphere. The term was sort of tossed about before him, but a rigorous definition of the biosphere, as this, as what Rachel was saying, this envelope of life, the envelope of the planet where living processes are governing it, not simply living material, but which are organized by life as sort of a geometric organizational process. That concept was rigorously defined by Vernadsky, who refutes decades before any of this environmentalism hits the population,
right.
Refutes it in principle, refutes it at its core.
And every time the radical environmentalists try to kidnap Vernadsky and make him one of theirs, it really doesn't work. Because as soon as, and we found this speaking with participants in the conference and others, who, yes, might have had a kind of simplified view of matters, maybe looking more at Podolinsky than at Vernadsky, or saying, oh yes, Podolinsky emphasized the sun and he was just extending what the French physiocrats of the 18th century believed in about the bounty of nature. He was just adding on the bounty of the sun. But as soon as those notions were challenged from a higher standpoint, such as Sky was just outlining, people got happy.
Yes.
This was largely older people. I want to say that we should discuss something about that. These were people, baby boomer generation scientists we were talking about, but they were happy. They had that quality which Taras Muranivsky had of being willing to change their axioms and excited about the process of thinking things through. The question of youth is obviously critical in every country, including Ukraine. I was joking that at the conference, Sky was certainly the youngest speaker. What was alarming is that possibly I, who am twice the age of Sky, might have been the second youngest speaker. Maybe close.
How about the attendees?
But one of the young attendees, a young woman who was helping us with translating, said, why aren't there any young people speaking?
And that we won't find a solution unless you're incorporating the youth into this dialogue.
And this is really a critical issue in Ukraine right now, because, look, this is 2009. The breakup of the Soviet Union came in 1991. And all of these countries, I mean, we know, look, Larry Summers was the case officer during the 1990s. One of the key case officers, together with Stanley Fisher from the IMF, in imposing, policing the imposition of so-called shock therapy, free trade, deregulation, liberalization, creation of stock markets, bond markets, hedge fund markets. These stories we've covered in EIR currently, we don't need to repeat them here. But the same thing was brought into Ukraine with hideous results, including the fact that from approximately 1992, 93, really almost till now, what were university students studying? They were not training to be the successor of Vernadsky. They've been getting business degrees and getting prepared to be part of the nouveau riche. And so now with the rapid collapse of industry, Ukraine was very export dependent with steel. Unfortunately, much of their steel capacity had been taken over by outfits like Arcelor and Mittal, asset stripped and now shut down. And the ripple effects of that are spreading through the economy. In Kremenchuk, we were received by the deputy mayor. We asked him what the impact of the crisis has been there. He said that many of their industrial plants, while they still exist, are on three-day weeks. Mm-hmm. So that's close to a 50% shutdown of economic activity. What are these would-be MBAs and high-paid execs going to do now? So the discussions we had with young people were extremely interesting in that regard.
And maybe in particular, you'd attempting to revive much, because we had a discussion, a number of discussions with the youth on this topic, and a number of whom expressed, this realization that sort of a realization of what had been done to them, what Rachel was just describing. And that this was the first time that they realized that, which is again ironic given the rich tradition there, that physical science was important to these existential questions of survival, these existential economic questions. And they were very thrilled, and even just to watch the discussion that was taking place. So we developed a number of contacts on that, but also at the university. And the idea is to have a, I mean, because you have at the university, you're having LaRouche's ideas discussed, you know, in classes, you know, with the students, these economic students. And the idea of really broadening that into a very high level collaboration and to capitalize on the rich tradition that they have there of Vernadsky and thinkers who are in the line of Vernadsky, in the line of LaRouche, to capitalize on that, I think is of utmost importance for the current crisis and ensuring the future of this, of civilization for generations to come, and producing with the LaRouche Youth Movement a very fruitful, I think, international collaboration.
I was going to say, you, in some sense, and people, I think, listening or on our phone message line, connecting that way, will know you can get on site, on the websites, the material or the presentations we're talking about. Sky's, yours is on the LaRouche Political Action Committee. People can find it. It's post.
And next week's EIR, the one dated May the 1st. We'll have a full written report on our tour, along with the message of greetings which LaRouche sent to the conference, which we read out loud there, and also the presentation which Sky gave at the conference, because his paper was the published article on creativity as a principle in physics. But he also gave at the conference a kind of live report on the work in the basement, including demonstrating some of the animations that the basement has online on their Dunamis site of for the study of Kepler's new astronomy. And this was particularly fun to show because there had been other animations at the conference, but they were conceptually at a lower level. They were, you know, kind of heavy on special effects and lighter mm-hmm. on the conceptual content. And the news that the LaRouche movement has an entire such approach, which is aims to create leadership, create thinking people. I should also say that was very exciting to the audience. All of the proceedings are to be published. The Podolinsky Society is committed to publishing of proceedings of the conference, which will include Lyndon LaRouche's paper in full in English and most of it in Russian, Sky's paper, the presentations. We don't yet have a final report back on a statement from the conference, but what we put on the agenda was the following. I reported to the audience that on our way to Kiev, we had stopped in Germany and discussed with Helga Zepp LaRouche, the founder of the Schiller Institute. And I said that she had expressed the hope that a resolution from this conference might exert a healthy influence on the creation of a coalition of countries intent on finding solutions based on physical economy at a time when the leaders of almost all countries keep throwing money into a black hole. And we proposed that the conference state that its participants have recognized the systemic nature of the world financial and economic crisis, and that they call upon scientists, statesmen, and citizens of all nations to seek solutions based on the ideas of physical economy in the tradition of Leibniz, Hamilton, Carey, Liszt, Mendeleev, Podolinsky, Vernadsky, and LaRouche. Now, this has not been adopted, but in the closing remarks, Vice Rector of the Kiev National Economic University, Stepanenko, you know, stated again their commitment to have an appropriate statement, and that the material, the formulation presented by myself would be, you know, incorporated into that in some way. So let's hope that they do that, because the message is critical for the world as well as for Ukraine.
Well, let me just tell people that for Sky's paper, I'm not talking about the conference presentation, it's October 17th, 2008 in the EIR, which is Human Creative Reason as a Fundamental Principle in Physics. That's also, I think, in 21st Century Science and Technology. But October 17, 2008, that's in the EIR, which is LaRouchePub.com. And so it's reductionist to me to say it's against reductionism, but do you want to say anything about, I mean, in the final minutes, about the nature of your, any specific discussion, the conference itself, or one of these other non-conference occasions, or Wolfgang Köhler, or how you, what people related to, or what you emphasize?
Well, to give people maybe also to broaden to what the receptivity there was, I mentioned one point, one of the fundamental points of LaRouche's conference presentation, his principle of mind, this idea of human creativity as central to a discussion in economics. But his opening theme, and the opening theme and the continuing theme throughout the paper, sort of to illustrate that, is his demonstration that the quest for a unified field theory that Einstein embarked upon for the end of his life and a number of other people have attempted to pursue is not resolvable outside of recognizing Vernadsky's unification of the three phase spaces, the abiotic, the biotic, and the noetic. That is, without a recognition of life as an independent principle in which matter partakes, and without the recognition of human cognition in the form of human economic processes, again, as an independent process, independent of the living, independent, subsuming the living, subsuming the abiotic, as a process in which matter takes place, without recognizing that these are aspects of matter, states of matter that are distinct from any observable state in the abiotic. Without recognizing that, the quest for a unified field theory is a hopeless one. But with that recognition, from the standpoint of human recognition of human creativity in classical artistic composition, human psychology, economic processes, physical science, how that subsumes biology, with that you can start to see matter from the top-down view that's required for unification. And I think that definitely gave a different spin to the economic discussions that were taking place at the conference.
And did people pick up on it over time right away, or when
people responded? I think in general there was a great receptivity. I mean, it's a new idea. This is something people haven't really been exposed to. LaRouche makes the point it's implicit in Vernadsky. It's something that we've been trying to work to bring out in recent work from the basement. Mm-hmm. But because it's implicit, and because people really were trying to struggle with these questions of what does it take to maintain human civilization in the face of a complete breakdown crisis like the one we're facing. Because of that, people's ability to receive and think about these ideas, I think, is greatly enhanced.
And LaRouche's stature, the fact that Lyndon LaRouche and his representative and one of the leaders of the basement crew was telling them that they needed to think about this, immediately made them really want to do it. And I think the now 15 years of physical economy beginning to be established as a legitimate field of study, even in the formal academic setting in Ukraine, this is not something which exists in that form in other countries. And it's an extremely powerful, would you say, platform or mm-hmm. takeoff point. Look, one of the speakers at the conference was somebody who wrote her PhD thesis on physical economy, the Ukrainian School of Physical Economy. We received a copy of it in Ukrainian. I was studying it, which is a little bit difficult to read because Russian is the language that we know better. But she has an entire chapter on LaRouche in a formally submitted PhD thesis at the National Economic University of Ukraine. This particular professor reported that you can't yet major in physical economy, but you can major in the history of economic science. And she lectures in the history of economic science. In that setting, she gives lectures on physical economy and LaRouche. And just the kind of institutionalization of recognition of LaRouche's stature and his continuing creative inspiration in terms of new pedagogies, new insights into physical and economic processes. One of the speeches in which he was cited was, in fact, by the Kremenchuk Museum director. whose presentation was on Vernadsky. In other words, the gentleman in Kremenchuk was also in Kiev
and
spoke at the conference, and his speech was on Vernadsky. And at the very beginning of his speech, he said, studying Vernadsky will help enable us to know, what we must do under conditions of truly unprecedented transformations of mankind, and an epoch that's weighted down by entry into that general financial and economic breakdown, which Lyndon LaRouche has been forecasting since 1983. Now, I'm interested to know why he picked 1983, which is the year of the SDI, but this was stated simply as you need to know about where we are in the universe, who said this was going to happen, who's competent, and therefore who you should listen to.
That's great. Let me just ask one thing. We are in the remaining minutes, but Rachel, you personally have been physically back and forth sometimes on things like physical projects, the Bering Strait Tunnel or some other railroads, the mm-hmm. Eurasian railroads, when you speak of institutionalization, what is the...
These ideas are so well known. I'll give two examples just from discussions during our meeting. One is we met with a new contact, a politically active person in her 40s, who is doing a lot of work with youth, trying to get youth to think about new economic policies, technology, and so forth. And I was briefing her on our concept of the Eurasian land bridge and the railroad development, going back to Mendeleev's idea about and Count Witte that a railroad brings cultural ferment, and you need to have development along the corridors, both sides of the tracks. And this woman looked at me and said, "Well, I think we should dismantle all the railroads." And so I was quite alarmed, and I was looking at her and said, "You do? And why would that be?" Well, because the technologies we're using are really totally outdated, and we need to have magnetic levitation train lines for many of the most important routes on the planet. So this this was just something that she talks about. This is a leader of a political party and a youth project. That's number one. Number two was with some interlocutors who maybe didn't get it in the same way, get what we were saying in the same way that some of these economists and scientists do. And this was the political economist with whom we were speaking on Monday the 13th, the transcript of that discussion being the one that's been published now under the headline "Bankruptcy of the World Financial System." One of these gentlemen just didn't believe that the world could go back to being a community of sovereign nation states. He said, if you have these big projects involving more than one country, which he also advocated, but he said they will have to have a master. Mm-hmm. There will have to be some supranational institution that's running them. Here's how the dialogue went. This gentleman said there'll be a new spiral upwards of transnationalization, globalization, only maybe it'll be physical. And I said, LaRouche believes that cooperation among nations is quite appropriate, that there are mutual interests, and that these arrangements can be made through treaties. He said, however, any new continental project will have an outside manager, a supranational manager. To which I replied, well, for example, I think that the United States and Russia could very well reach a treaty agreement on building a tunnel across the Bering Strait without bringing in a supranational supervisor. Okay. So that kind of discussion can be had. People know these are potential projects that could be on the agenda any day we choose to put them there.
That's great. Well, I think that closes our time on today. And I want to thank you both, Rachel Douglas and Sky Shields. This is April 25th, 2009. I will say on May 2nd, Summer Shields and Hussein Askari, who is the director of our Arabic Bureau for the EIR based in Scandinavia, who was in Sudan, in Africa, will be on the show. But everyone make sure April 28th, which is Tuesday, 1 p.m. Eastern Time out of the United States, on LaRouchePack.com, will be Mr. Lyndon LaRouche's international webcast on the topic, The Other Shoe Will Fall. This is Marcia Mary Baker. Thank you very much today, April 25th.